The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Anyhow, let's meet the panel. I'm joined in studio by Eamon Dunphy, RTE World Cup analyst, Dara Doyle, Bloomberg News Agency Bureau Chief in Dublin, Niamh Harrigan, Senior Lecturer in Sociology at University College Cork, Kate Feeney, one of the two Fianna Fáil counsellors for BlackRock in Dublin, the other being Mary Hanafin, and Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe. We normally talk to you down the line, Kevin,
so
it's a pleasure to have you in studio. And actually, before we kick off, you were due to meet Gerry Conlon, weren't you, on this trip?
I was, you know, it wasn't definitely set in stone, but it was on my list of what I was going to call Gerry, because I had heard he was not feeling well, and was very shocked to learn of his death yesterday. And Gerry and I had quite a session not long after his release in Boston, and I'll always remember what he told me. He had gone to Jamaica, and he said he really couldn't enjoy himself on holiday there because of the poverty he saw. And he said he gave away his shoes. When he got back on the airplane, he didn't have his shoes. He gave them to some young man who didn't have shoes. So very sad.
Yeah. The saddest thing for Conlon, for the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, freedom. Even after that miscarriage of justice, it wasn't freedom.
No, it wasn't. 14 years incarcerated in Gerry Conlon's case, and his father dying in prison. I don't think you recover from that unless you're made of stuff that I don't think Gerry was made of. I think he was a relatively normal guy, a nice guy. But, you know, I think the point, he went on fighting for justice until very close to his death. And he said the British and Irish authorities have not changed. And what happened to our family could happen again. And it's a tragic end to what was a tragic life in many respects. These are innocent people just lifted. And something makes all of us shiver if we think about it for long enough.
I had heard him on Miriam O'Callaghan's show a few months ago, and it was the best I heard Gerry in years.
They replayed a bit of it earlier.
Did they? Yeah. He sounded great. And it was interesting, the contrast, because his great friend and my pal, Paddy Joe Hill. Paddy Joe's not where Gerry was right now. And I think like a lot of guys that came out of that situation, both the Birmingham Six, the Guildford Four, they were treated for all sorts of things, but what they really were suffering from was post-traumatic stress. It's common in people in combat. It's it's a crisis in America right now, because the hawks that started those wars 10 years ago did not make any provisions for all the people coming home. And so what the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four people really suffered were like combat fatigue, this incredible, always on edge.
And even worse than when you've got this almost charade, this bizarre kind of movies being made about you, you know, standing on the red carpet one day, feeling even more empty the next.
Well, it's funny when you mention that, Anya, because I remember that's when Gerry came to Boston when they were promoting the film, and we went out on the tear. And I could even see that you know, this was going to be the greatest thing in his life. His whole story was up there. But, you know, at the end of the day, Gerry never forgave himself for dragging his father in there, even though he didn't do anything. He was an innocent man. But his father got dragged into prison, as he saw, because of himself. And he had an awful lot to wrestle with. I always felt bad for Gerry, and I always liked him, because I thought at the end of the day, he really had a good heart. He was a decent man.
Well, that's a really nice tribute to him. And I think, Ariet Degoro on him, and may he rest in peace, and may peace come to anyone who's been through those kind of experiences, that they find a space where they can be a bit more reconciled within themselves. But it does, and I was thinking about this last night, and given the whole controversy that's been going on here all week, and maybe, Niamh, you'd come in on this, about, you know, Niall Collins and then Eamon O'Queeve, but there are times when there are people behind bars who, whether they're innocent or whether they're guilty, do need some avenue of appeal. And isn't a politician the proper person to go to for that?
this is the difficulty of this situation. I was actually thinking when Kevin was talking about, you know, the hypervigilance that you have people who experience post-traumatic stress, and having done my own, so much of my own research on feuds, traveller feuds and gangland feuds, and you encounter so many people who are in precisely that situation and have that hypervigilance. You know, I encountered people who'd lived in Canada and the States and had come out of feud situations and were still in the feud in their head. They never left the feud. And I suppose the difficulty is that rule-based systems are not perfect. And I mean, even if you look at what Gerry Conlon was saying right up to his death, he's still highlighting the imperfections of criminal justice systems and rule-based systems, which are everywhere. And even when they're good, and they're not always good, and they don't, you know, they don't always necessarily operate from a basis of fairness in the starting point, but even when they're good, in situations where they get things wrong, they can be extremely slow moving to correct that. And also, often the people who tend to fall foul of rule-based systems are often people who come from maybe quite marginalised backgrounds.
Well, look at the Frank McBrearty case here.
Exactly.
And I mean, you know, look at the work that, you know, politicians like Brendan Howland and Jim Higgins put in on that case.
Yeah. And this is the tension, really, between rules and relationships in our culture. And this is what the Irish political culture, if you go back before the 1960s, before TACA, before the tribunals, and if you look at the period of from the 1920s to the 1960s, and you look at our kind of intimacy-based political culture, that's what politicians, a lot of the time, they were doing. You know, I mean, they were helping people with rule-based systems, often when people were struggling with systems that are quite obtuse. And, you know, while I wouldn't necessarily be supporting what Niall Collins did, it's very interesting if you look at some of the commentary this week in the papers about the HSE. And the HSE is a very interesting situation of a bureaucratic system in Ireland which had an intimacy layer in the health boards. It had politicians involved, and they took it out. And by and large, many would argue that the HSA is actually less efficient and less responsive. I mean, I've interviewed a woman last week whose daughter had a very serious illness, which was extremely rare, and she couldn't get any support from the HSE because they didn't have a box on their form to tick. Now, that's a scenario where a politician can intervene and say, well, hang on a minute, you may not have a form that fits this particular, but this woman has to take her child to the UK for treatment, and therefore there is a role there for that. And I think the problem is, Anya, that in the aftermath of the bailout period and the kind of elite relationships that was problematised by that, we're having a difficulty recalibrating this balance.
Well,
in
people
our culture
are allergic that looks, you know, to anything like the same old kind of political boys club, nod, nod, wink, wink, you know, running into somebody on the golf course, which is where it seems so much of the malpractice of the past came from. And that, Kate, is the problem for Fianna Fáil. There you are, the bright, shiny new face of the future. And here we are in Niall Collins and Eamon O'Quivan. It looks like same old, same old.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, this was always far more common in the past than it is now. And for me, that's where
but
it needs
to... But this
is the
present.
That's where it needs to stay, is in the past for me. I'm a new politician. And for me, it's something I wouldn't do. I think that the politicians should stay completely independent of the judiciary and let the judiciary do their own role. You know, now there is, and as Niamh said, there are kind of blurred lines there because, you know, politicians do take on responsibilities to represent their constituents, but they also take on a responsibility to be a standard bearer for morals and for ethics. And in the absence of...
Should he resign as justice spokesman, for instance?
Personally, I don't think he does. I think this was a mistake. It was a bad judgment call on Niall's part. I think he's played a very good role as justice spokesperson. And for me, as a younger member of the party and a newly elected councillor, you know, Niall has come out and he has admitted it was a bad move.
Well, he took his time coming out now.
He thought it over. I mean, and this was, as far as I'm aware, this was the first time Niall had made a representation of this kind. And they were very compelling circumstances. And I think you will give Niall that. For me, it doesn't justify it.
And what
I
about
still
Eamon
think
O'Quive? Why doesn't Micheál Martin do something about him? Because Eamon O'Quive says he's going to go on sending letters looking for prisoners to be moved, you know, in a situation where he's asked to do so.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, I'm... not here to defend Niall Collins or Eamon O'Keefe. I think there is a distinction to be drawn between the two and between contacting the judiciary and contacting the prison service. And, you know, Niamh kind of made reference to it with regards to the HSC, where...
So
you
it's
know,
okay to contact the prison service, is it?
Well, I think, you know, politicians are, and, you know, it's again, Niamh made reference to it, that a lot of the time these people are very marginalised within their societies and they don't have access to, you know, very, very strong legal representation or other advice services like that. So they do come to their politicians for it, whether it be with regards to healthcare or whether it be with regards to prison conditions. And they are deserving of representation. And, you know, they're, while it is uncomfortable for some people to talk about and some people don't like this idea, I don't think that they deserve any less representation than anyone else. And, you know, Eamon O'Keefe has a very strong record on this and he has said he will continue to do it. It's within his remit as an elected representative.
I don't think Eamon O'Keefe there is going to be persuaded by anything Micheál Martin would say to him anyway,
clear,
would he?
Not just tension there, absolutely. I kind of feel that, you know, there's been a bit of a rush to judgment on this one. You know, it's very easy, given the context that we've been talking about, to rush condemn Niall Collins. And you see the kind of headlines that were around. I'm not sure how much detail we can say but give about the case. But if you look at the case, it's an extremely tragic case of a widower with four kids under the age of 10. His crime, you know, okay, you can have a view on what it was, but, you know, in the very scheme of things, it wasn't particularly serious to some people. And, you know, immediately the headlines rush out, say this, you know, Niall Collins is doing something wrong here, is being inappropriate. I don't know. It
seems some of the political reaction as well was very... I mean, it's not just in the... Some of the headlines are coming from statements from politicians like the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste, for instance.
Exactly. Whereas if you take a couple of minutes and read the reports and paper, most people will go, God, that's a terrible case. You know, is there grounds for something that can be done here? Now, you can argue very legitimately that it's up to the person's lawyer to make those cases. It's not the job of a politician to make those cases. But I think occasionally we just need to take a breath, look at the circumstances rather than just look at headlines and rush to judge somebody like Niall Collins for doing something that a lot of people would have, you know, relative sympathy for.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, you can describe, anytime you have a legal case or a prisoner, you know, you can say they're a mass this, that and the other, or they're a parent of, you know, somebody, and that you can look at things in a very black
there
and white fashion.
There is a danger
fashion.
Here, yeah. And in fairness, I would like to see both Niall Collins and Eamon O'Keefe acknowledge it a bit more, is that if you're on the flip side of this debate, if you're somebody who's a witness or has to testify against somebody in this situation, and it can be very demoralising for people living in communities proximate to crime who have to testify, who have to go to court and then see somebody out on temporary release or out, you know, and because they're mitigating circumstances, a case has been made for them. And it can really undermine the criminal justice system in those areas. So I think that there's a balance here. And, you know, I would like to see politicians who engage in this kind of work. And, you know, again, I'm not supporting what alcoholism, but there needs to be more of an acknowledgement of the kind of sacrifices that a lot of people who go and testify in these situations make. And it's very, I mean, we saw this previously years ago with the Sheehy case, that it can really undermine the sense that the rules are legitimate or their rules are fair if you go too far down the road of mitigating circumstances. And I think that's the balance here.
Kevin, you're here to, one of the things you're here for, you're going to be reporting on the Chew and Baby case. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
What's the internet, because it's making headlines again today and people are asking questions, of course, about, you know, what's going wrong with children in care today. There was a big kerfuffle about that a couple of years ago and the numbers back up again. The international perception of these Irish institutional scandals, the treatment of women and babies?
Well, I think unfortunately, the shorthand has been, you know, nearly 800 babies were stuffed into a septic tank. That's the way it's played around the world. And I think what I'm hoping to get at is try to put it more in the context of the time, the place, and the idea that, you know, these institutions did not operate behind closed doors. Everybody knew what these places were. And it's easy to blame the nuns. I thought one of the more dramatic stories I heard, and I think I heard it on, it might have been on Joe Duffy's show on Liveline last week or the week before, was about when a young woman had a baby and her parents wanted to raise the baby. And it wasn't the parish priest who came and demanded that child go to more or less an orphanage. It was the neighbors. I found that to be the most shocking story that I've heard so far of this. So I really do want to spend a little time out there and get a better feel for this.
Did you see Conor Brady's piece today in the Sunday Times? It's an interesting article, isn't it?
It is, it is. And I think, I mean, I think it, to me, this is all healthy. I really do think. It's funny when you put it in the context, people up north are having so much time, trouble figuring out how to, you know, reconcile the past and how to come to some form of reconciliation, as we call it. But a lot of what's going on with these, you know, sort of piecemeal, drip-by-drip stories about institutions, I think it's almost a truth and reconciliation process down here, looking at what Ireland was like post-colonial.
Becoming reconciled with ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's healthy. I mean, I know I think some people say, oh, my God, not another tribunal, please. But I really do think it's important to confront this stuff. And somebody might say, well, we've been there. You know, you can go watch Philomena. But no, I don't think you've been there. I mean, this was news to a lot. I must say, that woman, Catherine Corliss, who did this, what a remarkable person to do what she did. And she did it when you heard her explain. She did it because she thought these babies should be recognized, that they should.
And Catherine Corliss brought new information together. But one of the points that Conor Brady is making today is that a lot of this information about mothers and babies and the treatment of women and death rates and illness rates and so on, a lot of it has been in the public domain for a long, long time. So when we're, you know, and there is now talk of inquiries, one of the things I wonder, Kate Feeney, because there you are, the young one in the group. But you know, when I talk to my kids, or I don't think younger people really get, in a way that you would get, Eamon, the attitudes, the valley of the squinting windows nature of the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you W.T. Cosgrave is regarded fondly by many people. He was a monster. He talked about the undeserving poor. This is one of the founding fathers of our political system, and they're still, that dynasty is still around. He talked about the undeserving poor, how we should care nothing for them, and how they would be far better off if they left the country. Now, he said this in 1922 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they, of course, were heavily linked to the Catholic Church and its attitudes. About people.
But that attitude was widespread. I even remember, you know, when I went to school, there were kind of families that the nuns would have regarded as, you know, respectable families that, you know, a lot of effort was made for. And there were poor families that they did not regard as respectable.
The consequence of regarding people as undeserving of compassion, charity, justice, the consequence were these homes and these attitudes to something like what were called illegitimate children. So this was a country that was black, bleak, heartless, and run in the interests of an elite in society.
And is it a country you understand, Kate?
I mean, society has obviously changed dramatically.
It's no big deal if a girl gets pregnant.
It's not a big deal. And I mean, and this is back to a time where there was scant respect for women's rights, quite frankly. And I mean, women have a far stronger standing in society today. And that's, you know, that's evident and obviously very important. But I think for...
But this went on up to the 80s. You could have a teacher sacked for being a single mother. Sacking backed by the institutions of this state. You know, it's not so very long ago.
It's not so very long ago, which I think in some ways probably goes to show how much we have come on, that someone of my age, I'm 28, just could not fathom that someone, you know, could be fired for something like that. But I think it is important what we do with this. And because, you know, as I said, this went on in plain sight. And we all knew about it. And obviously, it's been highlighted again through the Tune Babies case. And I think for me, it's not enough for us to be appalled. And it's not enough for us to investigate it and have a report.
So where do we go with an inquiry? Well, if it was so widespread, if it was the neighbours and the families, what do we inquire into? How do we seek justice, Niamh?
Well, I mean, if we look, and Kevin raised the point about the truth and reconciliation process, and both in South Africa and the North, forth. And there's kind of three planks of those. First of all is to establish the truth. And I think at the very minimum, that's what we have to do. I mean, I think there needs to be some kind of documenting of the numbers of babies who died in these homes. I mean, the mortality rate was 56% compared to a 15% mortality rate in the normal population, populations outside the home. The second thing is justice. Now, it's a completely different situation, I think, here when you look at the question of justice, because obviously there is an issue for orders who are involved in running these homes. But as Kevin and others have highlighted, you know, they were operating a context where they were widely supported in society. It wasn't like people didn't know. I mean, Catherine Corliss herself, when she talks about her motivation for doing this study, is, you know, she was at school with the home kids and they were being bullied. And that was a bullying that her classmates were sharing in, do you know what I mean? As well as the order. So there's a bigger issue and a bigger difficulty there around justice. And then I suppose the issue is, what kind of supports are there for people who have survived that system today?
Could I just say something, Honey, about this? This hasn't gone away. For example, the orders involved in these things are refusing to pay compensation, offering token sums of money. The settlements that were made for previous, you know, appalling, they were made by the Bertie Ahern government with religious orders. They haven't paid. This isn't a new Ireland we're in. This is an unreformed Ireland. The people who are doing these things and, you know, who are laying down the law, both politicians and people in the church, are still doing the same and ignoring the wishes of the people who want to see, if we talk about the issue of compensation, which is a form of justice, they won't pay. And it's there. It's happening in plain sight, I think, as Kate said. We're not doing anything. Why aren't the papers campaigning every day about a deal Dr. Michael Woods did when the Ahern government was in power a few years ago with the orders? A, there was a good deal for the orders, and B, that they haven't paid up on.
There's a bigger issue again. Of course, we've moved on, but still, the Catholic faith dominates our education system. In this country, if you want your kids primary school not to go to a Catholic school, it's extremely difficult to find a Catholic school. If you want your kids not to make communion within that Catholic school, it's very difficult to do that. So, of course, we move on. I'm not for a moment comparing what we have now. The schools these days are absolutely fantastic. But you shouldn't forget for a moment, I mean, I walk into my children's schools, there's crucifixes everywhere. Now, you can take that, you can leave it, but it's there. So this idea that we've kind of moved on, New Ireland, I mean, it's not true in a lot of ways. The Catholic Church is the dominant faith, and I accept that you have to accept that you live in Ireland, that's the way it is. But to suggest this is some kind of New Ireland where you can live a sort of very secular life, free from the influence of the church, I'm afraid isn't true, especially if you've got children in this country.
Still, the other thing that we haven't heard from the orders is we haven't really heard much from the nuns, the few that are left, about their take on the whole thing, about how they came to run the system the way they did, to make the decisions the way they did, how rooms came to be called idiots' rooms or whatever. I mean, Kevin, is that something you worry about?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw that actually in America. And when you talk about, getting back to your original point, Anya, of this information being out there and people knowing it, when I was part of that team at the Boston Globe, you know, in 2002, that got the records for, we all knew that that priests were having, you know, were sexually abusing children, but we didn't put it all together until that year, and then everybody started chronicling, and it was really important to put something together that put it on the record, and I think that's in the same context here, but that, you know. It's funny because I remember once when we were doing a book thing about that, I was at the Boston Public Library and somebody got up and he had religious medals all over him. And he said, you talk about the priests, you talk about the priests, you never talk about the nuns. Why don't you talk about the nuns? And I took a sip of water, leaned into the microphone, and my sotto voce said, because we're still scared of them.
Look, you're talking about reform and things not being reformed. And one big question in another sphere about the lack of reform was raised when we had the economist of the moment, Monsieur Piketty, who came to Ireland. And he's the big guy who's talking about global wealth inequality. And he's got lots of theories about basically the rich are going to get richer and the working poor are going to get even more working poor as the 21st century goes on. And there's a statistic, and it wasn't a mad lefty I heard say this, the 85 richest people in the world would fit in a double-decker bus. Their wealth is equal to the wealth of half the world's population, 3.5 billion. So you have 85 people and half the world's population. Now, Dara Dore, there has to be something wrong there, but is there any government, any system that's going to come anywhere near to solving that one?
God, it's a big question on you. In fairness, I mean, the key message from Piketty is the past, the virus, the future. So if you're wealthy, if you've got wealth in your past, that sort of sets your future course in life.
So inherited wealth sets you up.
Essentially, that's how it works.
Working wealth is going to see you poor in your old age.
Not necessarily. That can work out for you as well. But
so if we change our tax system.
Just where Piketty's kind of coming from, there's not a huge amount of dispute about his core point, which says there's a greater inequality of income and wealth. There's very little dispute about that. There's people are quibbling around the data. But that's clear. The problem really with the Piketty analysis comes down to what his proposed solution is. What Piketty's suggesting is that there should be a global wealth tax. So basically to take money off the wealthy and pass it on. There's two clear issues with that. On a practical level, how do you implement a global wealth tax? I mean, as you know, we're trying to implement, some countries in Europe are trying to implement a financial transaction tax at the moment. It's not working because countries won't go along with it. The second issue is if you don't have every country involved, the wealthy just move their wealth to the one country that doesn't have a wealth tax. So there's somebody's a tax haven, so the wealthy just moves our cash away.
Well, that's what we're told here again and again. The reason we can't have higher taxes is that the money, rich people would simply move their money away.
It's why wealth tax generally doesn't work and generally tends to be abolished. And the second bigger question, I mean, a lot of the left have latched onto Piketty. I was at the event in Crow Park with Piketty a couple of days ago, and you know he was like a celebrity rock star. People were applauding his every move. It was a primarily left-wing audience. But if you go to follow Piketty's analysis, where it ends up is that you try and redistribute wealth, not necessarily within a country, but between countries. So you take wealth from, say, you know, the wealthy in Ireland or the middle class in Ireland, and distribute to the poor in Africa, South America, etc. So I'm not sure if the audience realise that. I mean, this in global terms,
no,
these
I don't think so.
In global terms, these people would have been quite wealthy. The money would have been taken from them and given internationally. So I think there's a lot to be said for Piketty. His analysis his data is excellent. His analysis is excellent, but probably the weakest part of his analysis is where the solution kind of comes from. So he's identified a problem that we probably knew was there anyway. You know, wealth and global inequality and income inequality. His solution, I don't really see it.
But at the same time, it's happening in a context where people are sick of austerity. There's a budget coming up, and they kind of go, you know, we've gone through all of this, and has the country really changed, or are the rich still getting away from it and the poor still footing the bill?
There's a much bigger issue in terms of what Piketty is doing, and he's part of a kind of a slew of economists that are coming more and more to the fore at the moment, because if we look at where the whole kind of ideology of austerity is coming from, and we're locked very much into that now, both from the ECB and from the IMF, and these are two institutions that are very publicly married to a kind of neoliberal Chicago school form of economics, which is about really privileging the markets, and that we hear that all the time. We hear coming from the fiscal commissions, we must do what the markets need. And I suppose one of the problems with that whole approach to economics is that the question of what happens to the money after it goes through the markets is one that really they don't devote that much attention to. I mean, you know, one could say that really by privileging the markets all the time, you're privileging rich people getting richer, which is essentially what Piketty is saying. What's interesting about Piketty in terms of his way of getting into mainstream economics is he's actually putting the question of inequality right at the centre in a way that the neoliberal economists have largely ignored. And to that extent, and to the extent that other people are doing this at the moment, it is presenting a kind of a challenge to this idea that austerity is the only way to do things, and that this is the recipe. Because, and it's very interesting to see that, you know, a lot of the presentation of like why we should do this austerity is because economists say so, but now you have a division emerging within economics itself, and saying a bunch of economists saying actually this is not what we say, and even if you look at the sums, there are parts of the sums that don't add up to austerity.
Well, the Sunday Times, Noonan will defy the IMF and we'll only have 1 billion in cuts in the budget.
Sorry, with the greatest respect, Niamh, a lot of that is just absolute nonsense.
It's not nonsense, Dara.
It's not the ECB and the IMF that impose austerity. What imposes austerity is that if you run a budget deficit, you have to borrow money from somebody else. Sorry, just hear me out. So you have to borrow money from somebody else. You've got to persuade somebody to give you 2 billion euros. They'll only give you the money back if they think you're able to pay it back. Yeah, so the fact was what happened in our crash was we couldn't borrow any money anymore at an interest rate of 10, 11, 12%. We had nowhere else to get money.
Yes, but Dara, now, if you look at the rationale for living within our means only operates when there's some snowball's chance in hell that you can actually repay the money that you owe. If we look at NAMA, and the rationale for having NAMA is that it was recognised that a bunch of developers who had borrowed a significant amount, there was no way that they were ever going to repay what they should owe, and therefore they should take a haircut. Now, you could look at that rationale and apply it to Ireland, but what's being applied to Ireland is a PIP model, which is basically saying we'll put you through at all kinds of very stringent measures.
There are a lot of people who aren't fancy economists and don't understand, you know, what Thomas Piketty is on about, but they do understand that the bust was unfair, that they've been paying for other people's debts. Those people are going to be grand job Nora within a couple of years, and they're still going to be paying the debts. That's the way an awful lot of people out there feel. Are they wrong?
Okay, you mentioned that the people that are hurt most through austerity are, you know, the relatively low income groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where the issue would have been, going back to 2010, we couldn't have had a bailout. We couldn't borrow from the international markets. If you can't borrow from the international markets, just hear me out here. What do you have to do? One of two things you have to do. You can't pay, meet your budget. You either raise taxes immediately or you immediately cut services. So you immediately cut the spend on education. You immediately cut the spend on health, which hurt among the lowest income groups. Okay. So where do we get the money? We had to go to a bailout. That's where the money came from.
Yeah, but Dara, hang on a minute.
Sorry,
why did we need the money in the first place? Is because...
Okay, let's bring in some others on this, Eamon.
Well, yeah, I think, Dara, there's a struggle going on, an international struggle, between the markets or the wealthy, the oligarchs, the corporate influence. The corporations are the cancer, and governments. Are we running economies or are we running societies? There was a time when the economic news of the day was down in the lower left hand of the newspaper and no one paid much attention to it. Now it's the headline news. We have to have societies. And if the answer to your question is the European Central Bank could have printed the money.
If Germany had let it.
Well, exactly. But you see, don't forget that Germany got the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. And that was a printing of money to save Germany. Now, we need, in Europe, the countries like Greece, ourselves, Portugal, need a Marshall Plan. And I'll tell you, Piketty's interesting because he's French. There is absolutely no way France is working economically. Its fiscal problem is terminal. Now, free creche for everybody, free health service, retire at 61. And sometimes, in the case of people who drive trains, 55. Okay? So, if they try to put France into a program, Europe will implode. And that's what's going to have to happen. Now, Piketty is saying we can't go on this way, where oligarchs are more powerful than politicians. Politicians have to restore their power and their influence. Journalism and broadcasting has to become primary as a way of informing society and highlighting injustice. But all of these things are being reversed in this vast endeavour.
And it's not unique to Europe. In the United States, Kevin, one of the biggest political problems is the erosion of the middle class, that it's harder and harder on a working income, even two working incomes, to sustain what people thought of as the American middle class lifestyle.
The gap between rich and poor is, I think, probably the biggest issue. I think it has surpassed racism. It's the biggest issue facing America. And it's funny what Eamon said. I don't think Cosgrove could ever be Taoiseach if he were alive today, but he probably could be the Republican nominee for president in the United States. States,
yes.
Because the animosity, the absolute contempt for the poor, yes, runs through that. And it runs through a lot of people. Even if you go to Boston, there's a right-wing newspaper in town, the Boston Herald. Almost every day they run stories blaming the poor, yep, for the problems that we face. Is it, you know, people have these EBT cards, they get free cash. And what is going on is a lot of this, particularly from the right wing, they're being funded by oligarchs like the Koch brothers. And the other thing that happened, which I think is devastating for American democracy, was 2 years ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people too. And corporations can give as much money as they want to political people, and they do. And so our political system has gotten worse and will continue to get worse because there is unlimited money and it's coming. I mean, it's when you use the word oligarch, people in America don't like to use that word, Eamon, but I'll tell you, it fits.
Yeah, let me just say on you that, you know, Barack Obama was elected in 2008 on a wave of hope and rhetoric. And he, the first call he made when he got to the White House, he ran on the banner of change and reform. And he gets to the White House, I think it was Alan Stewart who said this, first call he makes is to Larry Summers, ex-Goldman Sachs, arch-capitalist, you know, who's part of this real conspiracy against working people. So Obama wasn't for change. If the most powerful politician in the world can do nothing, and he has been able to do nothing, there are economists like Paul Krugman who support Piketty in general, who are anti-austerity, who have fought and fought. And there are other economists as well, Nobel Prize-winning economists who are against it. But what we can't get are politicians to take up the cudgels on behalf of the people, because they're closer to the oligarchs than they are to the people. So and that includes David Cameron in Britain and Osborne, his chancellor. Okay. They're on the yachts, drinking the champagne with the oligarchs. They're not down with the people.
Bringing it all back home then, we've got to have a budget in the autumn. And Jack O'Connor is saying, you know, and you've all this Labour leadership and, you know, the IMF should butt out of Irish politics and they should be told to get lost and so on, and statements like that being thrown around the place. Michael Noonan will defy the IMF and so on. And a lot of people wondering whether, if in fact, Labour will decide to save itself by possibly walking over the budget, making an issue of principle on it. Kate Feeney, how do you think that's likely to go?
I mean, this is big and it's on a lot of the front pages today about whether or not it will be the 2 billion cut. I mean, for me...
And whether or not the two parties will be able to do the deal.
And that's it, exactly. And I suppose for me, I mean, we've seen in the past, you know, budgets of politics, you know, ruling stronger than budgets of economics. And I thought lessons have been learned in that regard. And, it seems that we're not. And this budget is now more again about the Labour leadership race than it is a lot of other things. And, you know, I think that it's we have to be very, very prudent, you know, both the political classes and citizens and to be responsible and to say, like, you know, yes, the IMF are gone and, you know, but the crisis isn't over and we need to.
So what about all those hints about, you know, helping people out on water charges or helping people out on the tax bans or helping people out on the tax rates?
Well, I think that's politically irresponsible if I'm being very, very honest about it. And a lot of that is what brought us
to the 2 billion.
To where we are. I think when you have organisations, you know, like the IMF, like the Fiscal Advisory Council, telling you, you know, that this is the way to go, you know, it was being fiscally irresponsible that led us, you know, to
mind
where
you,
we
the
are.
The voters in the recent local and European election.
You know, and that's not too long ago, Eamon.
I just say to you, Kate, the IMF detest what the European Central Bank are doing, and they're two members of the Troika. There is no consensus among these guys. The idea that we need to, for fiscal reasons, to take 2 billion out this year in October is preposterous. It's preposterous. Well, our society is falling apart. Go into any hospital, go anywhere in the country, and see the suffering that's being caused by this austerity fetish. And I'd like you to answer this, Dara.
Sure.
This is a fetish. We're talking about a wealthy nation in a wealthy continent, and we have to go on enduring this suffering instead of somebody in a wealthy country like Germany writing a cheque, you know, for a few billion.
Okay, ultimately, it doesn't really matter what the Fiscal Council say. It doesn't even matter what the IMF say.
It shouldn't even
be the Fiscal Council. Just hear me, because you're not going to like the second part now. Sorry. Okay. the first part you get, the second part you're not going to like. Ultimately, it comes down to will the investors lend you money? Okay? And reality is, our interest rates have come down to below 2% or so. So we're actually below the US. So actually, it doesn't really matter what the IMF say. The markets have made their judgment of Ireland. And the reason they've done that, it'd be lovely to think it's because of what we've done. And it is partly because of what we've done in terms of reducing the deficit. But about a year and a half ago, Mario Draghi said, I'll do whatever it takes to keep the euro together. And the market said, sort of surrendered and said, OK, no matter what happens, Draghi's going to save Europe. So we can have an argument here about, you know, the margins, 300 or 400 million euros. Investors outside Ireland don't actually care that much. They've decided Ireland's a reasonable good bet. They will lend to you. Noonan realises this. Noonan realizes that, you know, he can take a few risks around the way. He can go for 1 billion instead of 2 billion. It's not going to matter too much.
So is this some great political game being played?
He's at the point where he realizes that he's convinced the markets, and now he's got to convince the electorate and get re-elected. He's got a little bit of scope to do that. Because the markets have said, that's okay. We believe that you're good for this cash. So ultimately, that's what it comes down to. Do the international investors and markets.
Alternatively, what you call the markets are the people who want to reduce living standards, who want to roll back decades of social democratic reform that has given people entitlements in health, education.
I mean, I would say these are the people that are keeping the schools open and the health system
no,
open.
No, they are not the people who are keeping...
Where do you think the money's coming from?
Every nation in history has always lived on borrowings. And if you, I'd put this question to you. Who would have lent to the Germans in 1947?
What would the markets have said? There's no doubt, of course, that's right. But the money.
Well, who did lend to them?
The money is being borrowed. But you have to convince the people. Sorry, just hear me. Yeah. You have to convince the people who are borrowing the money that you're good for the money.
Yeah.
And at the moment, they are convinced. At the moment, they're convinced that we can pay the money
back. But now, this is critical. You're right. How have they convinced the markets? By crucifying their own people who they are elected to represent and whose interests they're elected to represent. That's how they've impressed the markets, and that's wrong. They should be trying to impress us.
But Dara, the chicken and egg problem here is that by engaging in all this austerity to convince the markets, and I mean, if we look at the original inception of the European Union, it was because the previous 50 years had featured such extremism, which was largely the product of inequality. Now, because of the deep inequalities created by austerity, you push societies further towards the extremes, and I think you can make a convincing case that that will be the case, then the markets gradually will also start to see that and get jittery again. Do you know what I mean? The markets' own preferences, which to me often seem to be very shallow in some ways and very ideologically driven rather than data driven in some cases, you know, they could actually end up pushing societies. And we've seen this with structural readjustment in you know, Africa and Asia and South America. You can push societies into a place where the market doesn't function at all.
Sure, absolutely. But the other side of that is without being able to borrow money, you have to have instant austerity multiplied by 3 to 4. So if you're talking about social unrest, you'll be talking social unrest multiplied. We've had so little social unrest here because essentially a lot of the stuff, the hospital schools have been kept open by the bailout.
Sorry, just hear me out here.
Sure. So you're talking about the rise of you know, very sort of left-wing, sorry, difficult populist parties, sorry, apologies. That would be so much more so if you couldn't borrow money from international markets, because the cuts would have to be far greater.
I suppose for me, what's happening here is it's the mix-up in the figures and where the 2 billion is coming from, because the Indo is telling us about how Fine Gael are very happy with the tax takes to date so far, but we should be cautious because last year they went down in the second half of the year
good and to make Fine Gael look good. Isn't that the way it's going to go?
But I mean, and that's not what we should be doing with our budgets. I think it's far too early for us.
That's what every government does.
And it's wrong. And it shouldn't have happened. And I mean, this is where I think, as someone who's new to politics, would be looking at it and saying, we should be trying to manage expectations rather than set unrealistic expectations. And that's a lot of what got us here. And I think back to the figures again. I mean, in the Indo, they're talking about 500 million coming from water charges, while in the Business Post, they're saying that 500 million isn't actually available anymore. There's not enough information there for people to make a call.
The big question for any relief is where the money would come. Look, the man who's going to have to make the final call on all of this is Enda Kenny, and we're going to be talking about him with Gay Byrne after this break. Kevin Cullen thinks we're pagans and Eamon Dunphy is unimpressed, but it is within 25 seconds. And we'll hear more about this later with an astronomer. But it is actually coming up to 11:51, which is the moment of the actual solstice. It is the actual moment in the sky when the sun is, we're closest to the sun and we're highest in India. Anyhow, it was a beautiful night. It was a gorgeous morning. The weather's fantastic and it's just, why wouldn't you be happy? Let's talk about Enda Kenny now, and let's talk to Gay Byrne. Gay, good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Anya.
Now, you're talking to Enda, or you've been talking to Enda Kenny for The Meaning of Life, and it goes out tonight at 10:05 on RTE1. How much does faith matter to Enda Kenny?
Well, what you're going to get is a picture of a man who was born in the heart of rural Ireland in the county of Mayo in a home dominated by the GAA and politics. and he became a teacher. He was in the middle of a family of five. He became a teacher, and then his father died at 62, rather quickly, and he was thrown into politics, and that's what you get. And he's a fairly straightforward man who was brought up, of course, a Catholic, but he went out of his way to make the point that it wasn't an unduly devout home, insofar as they did not have the family rosary. They were not plastered with holy pictures and scapulars and miraculous medals and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, it was a Catholic home, and his mother did most of the rearing because his father was away in this big city of Dublin doing his political thing. So that's what you get, a fairly straightforward man. And yes, he does bring his beliefs into his political life, but not to any sort of pained or straining extent, if you understand.
And does he talk to you about the abortion controversy and the protection of life in pregnancy, Bill?
Well, now, can I be at pains to tell you that this is not a political interview. It is not a political program. The meaning of life comes out of the Religious Affairs Department, and it is supposed to be about spirituality and religious beliefs and that sort of thing. So let's get that straight first and foremost, because it's going to be criticized on the basis that you didn't ask him this, 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 and this, and those are questions for political programs. Yes, it was brought up, and he gives an explanation as far as he is concerned of what that was about, and Lucinda Crichton and all of that. Yes.
What struck you about his temperament?
His temperament. He is a man who is eternally and totally and completely optimistic. He is a man who is eternally, totally glass half full, has no time for glass half empty. And he makes the point that going around the country, he is absolutely buoyed up by what he sees as the optimism of the people, and particularly the young people who are glad to be given something to strive for, something to make an effort for, something to be inventive about, something to bring about. And he is constantly on the up rather than the down, unlike probably most of the rest of us.
And what about, because you mentioned his sense of his family and his community and where he comes from. Fionnuala is very important to him. I mean, that really is a big... Is that
Fionnuala
a big part
important.
Of his life stability?
Fionnuala is very important, and he speaks about meeting her, and he speaks about the fact that she was a Fianna Fáil press officer, and she went from being a Fianna Fáil press officer to an RTE press officer, whether that's a step up or a down, that we leave everybody else to imagine. And he talks about having winked at her in mid-speech in the Dáil. She happened to come in on Fianna Fáil business into the press gallery, and he spotted her in the press gallery, and in mid-speech he gave her a wink, and as he says in the interview, that's the wink that swung it.
We have that clip. Let's play it.
I first saw her at the corridors in Leinster House. And obviously I was very attracted to her.
Were you?
I was. I have never met anybody like her in the sense of an attraction there that I just couldn't resist.
Did she feel the same way about you when her eye fell upon you as you did about her?
I hope she did.
No, don't hope. Did she?
She did.
Is it true that in mid-speech in Dáil Éireann, she was in the press gallery and you actually winked at her?
It is.
It is.
Because she came into the press gallery with obviously some Fianna Fáil press statement to give to the journalists who were on the gallery. Mm-hmm. So I gave her the old wink. Maybe it was the one that mattered, I'm not sure.
It was very unparliamentary, Taoiseach, to say the least of it.
It was in the days before television.
Yes, well, I think there should be an investigation into that.
Michael McInerney took note of it.
Indeed.
There is this rule, of course, in the Dáil that it's absolutely verboten, even though people are in the press gallery and can see the politicians, but you're supposed to act like you're not there and they're supposed to act like you're not there. So looking up and winking was very bold indeed. And you've your own golden anniversary this week, Gay, I understand.
Well,
is that right?
There, first of all, is an official admission from Fine Gael that something good can come out of Fianna Fáil. All too rarely, admittedly, but nonetheless it can. So let that go in there for the record, although it's not a political programme.
Well, congratulations to you and Kathleen this week, Gay. And that is on at 10:05 tonight, is it, on RTE?
10:05 on RTE. Do not be affrighted. Don't let your listeners be terrified. There is nothing in the interview to upset the tranquil nature of their Christian lives.
Very glad to hear it, Gay, and a pleasure to talk to you as usual.
Thank you, Anya.
Well, a lot of you smiling listening to that clip, particularly Evander romancing Fionnuala. But she is, I mean, it is very important to him, that sense of bedrock. And sometimes you wonder in a politician, is temperament more important than, you know, maybe intellectualism?
Yeah, well, the other thing, of course, about Ende is that he's a Taoiseach from outside of Dublin. And I think that creates actually differences in terms of the leadership, also in terms of the kind of demands that being Taoiseach, because if you look at, say, Bertie Ahern, Charlie Haughey, a lot of the Fianna Fáil leaders, even Brian Cowan, didn't have as much of a commute as Ende did. So in a sense, I think maybe having a strong home fire burning situation is probably very important.
I actually went to Ende's defence last year in Boston because the Archbishop of Boston, Sean O'Malley, read him out and insisted that Boston College should rescind its honorary degree that it gave to the Taoiseach.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
And
yeah.
I wrote a column saying that what O'Malley, they weren't mad about the Taoiseach's position on abortion. They were mad about the gimlet eye of a canon lawyer speech that he made on the floor of the Dáil 3 years prior. That's what that was about. O'Malley is not that kind of a contentious person. He got marching orders from the Vatican and that he was supposed to embarrass the Irish premier. And that's what they tried to do. But in the end, Kenny came, he was really embraced in Boston specifically because he was seen as standing up to the people in the Vatican.
But Dara, when Gay spoke there about his optimism, and, you know, that's obviously a huge advantage to anyone, but you wonder, particularly when somebody's a Taoiseach, and in many ways, you know, your handler's all around you, you're inside a bubble, you know, talking about going around the country and seeing the Irish people's optimism, is that really in tune with the mood of the country at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, one thing he's probably not given enough credit for is how disciplined he is. I mean, he'd often be in the States and he'd go into our studios in the States doing interviews and, you know, I'd give the interviewers 15, 20 different questions. And the man learns a script and he, you know, he says it no matter which way you come at him. He says the same sort of optimistic, upbeat, you know, message all the time. I kind of wonder, is it beginning to wear off a little bit? Are people beginning to get a little bit sort of tired of it if their own circumstances aren't improving? So again, a lot of time I get questions from my colleagues in Brussels who genuinely see him as a contender for a top European job. And I would have said up to 6 months ago, absolutely no chance, he'll never go. And they keep coming back saying, no, we see him as a contender, his name's constantly being mentioned. And again, I would have said, no, he's never going to go. I'm kind of beginning to wonder now. He doesn't seem to be enjoying the job as much as he did a year ago.
And the chances, of course, seem to be increasing because David Cameron has said formally today, hasn't he? He's going to block Mr. Juncker, who's being backed by Germany. Apparently, he has brandy for breakfast, and this is one of his crimes. He's anyhow being opposed because he's a federalist. So, Enda's name cropping up more and more. Yeah. And interesting, was it the Mail? Somebody reporting today that Fionnuala now favours the move to Brussels. So that might be the most significant thing
that
there.
Could be it.
But I've been told that his big ambition is to win a second term. I don't think even Gareth Fitzgerald won a second term.
Interviewed him on that question, you see, I think actually the funny thing, we've had previous Taoiseach who wanted top European jobs and didn't get them. I suspect Enda doesn't want it, but may get it. And that may be the most poison chalice of all. Anyhow, we've lots more to talk about after 12, but it is now midday. So we go to Michael Murphy in the newsroom for the news summary. Kevin Cullen.
Yes.
Butter and coffee?
What do you mean?
What's with this craze in America for butter and coffee? And apparently Kerrygold are selling loads of extra butter because Americans have gone mad for butter and coffee. Have you ever tasted
anything
it?
Anything that can get us fatter, we will eat. We are not, you know, we are very into American exceptionalism and we are determined not to be just the fattest nation on earth. We want to die earlier. We are very serious about this.
So you're not going to be going into your Starbucks getting a barista to give you a special butter. It's probably got a funny name. And there's this whole thing as well now of viral thing of secret names for drinks. And it's not on the menu. Only the kids know about it. And it's all to get them to buy more.
I must say, one thing that struck me just coming in, walking around today, there are Starbucks everywhere in Dublin. Is it me?
Yeah.
Or are they just, is this relatively new? There's one up on the green now, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And a lot more of them appearing, it seems, all the time. Are you a Starbucks fan, Kate?
I am a big caffeine fan, I have to admit.
You see, it's that generation. They were born with coffee cups in one hand and phones in the other. Isn't that right, Kate?
That's it.
Listen, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. I can't let you go without looking for your side of the Battle of Blackrock.
Yeah. Look, I suppose it's... It was a national story that was turned into a very local one. I think, you know, for me, my campaign started in May last year, and I just had to keep my focus on winning my seat for myself, and for the same reasons being that I thought I could fill a gap on the council, and I thought I could be a good representative. I mean, I suppose the other angle of the story was more to do with Mary's relationship with the party and our candidate selection process than it was to do with me. And I just happened to be the other person and got caught in the eye of the storm. And
well, you were tough enough, though, weren't you, in the eye of the storm, because you were refusing to budge.
Not that I was refusing to budge. I mean, I was asked my opinion as the candidate in the area. And I mean, Fianna Fáil aren't particularly strong in Blackrock. And we are. And I mean, any political party who says they're not in the business of winning seats is lying. And that is what we're there to do. And that's what I wanted to
do. Did you think there were two seats in it?
I didn't, and that is my honest opinion, and that's the opinion that I gave the committee at the time, that I genuinely did not think there was two seats, and I thought that running two candidates, very much we were going to run the risk of not winning any seat, and you know that would have been a very bad outcome for us as a
and
party.
And a repeat what happened when she ran with and Barry Andrews
exactly,
ran as well.
Exactly, a repeat of 2011 for us out in Dunleary. So you know, it was as it worked out, we both got mandates and we both got seats. And
did you meet each other at the count and make up, or
we
have
actually,
you spoken
we
to
actually
her since?
Didn't we actually didn't cross paths at the count centre, but we are both on the council, and as it turns out we sit beside each other at council meetings with the seating arrangements. So look, I'm looking forward to working with everyone who's elected, and I think it's important that we all put campaign you know, issues aside and focus on the job that we've been elected to do. And for me, I suppose I very much over the next few years want to prove to people that they made the right choice by putting a number one beside my name.
Yeah, you're saying all the right things anyway, aren't you?
Thank you, Bonia.
Why do you want to go into politics as a matter? Why does somebody who's 28 years old, who could be living a good life, want to go in and sit in Dáil Éire and want to drag Fianna Fáil back into where it wants to be in power or whatever, and to decide where it's going? And
for me, I've never really been one to sit on the sidelines and to kind of let other people make decisions that influence my life, with if I don't feel that I'm being represented at the table.
Because you're just going to get slagged for the rest of
your
life now.
I suppose currently, it's already started. It's already started. But I do think it's very important that people get involved, and people from all age groups and all you know, backgrounds in society. And that is the only way that we have, you know, truly reflective decisions coming forward. And, you know, our political system is far from perfect. And there's a lot of changes that need to be made. And I suppose I want to be part of making those changes.
Well, fair play to you. And any young person who gets involved in politics, I think it is it's a really tough life.
And Eamon,
you thought about it.
Well, Eamon did promise off air that he might come out canvassing at least.
This is a brilliant politician in the making.
So when you've Eamon Dunphy's backing, what can you do?
I think
Micheál, if he's listening, is probably choking on his green tea at the idea of Eamon Dunphy going out canvassing for Fianna
I think I'd be very happy to do it.
Eamon, I would have thought you would have learned your lesson about, you know, saying things off air.
Will you canvass for Mary Hannafin or just Kate?
I can canvass for Kate specifically.
All right. Well, listen, Kate, thank you very much
thank
for coming
you
in
much for having
to talk to us. We have lots to talk about between now and 1 o'clock, the summer solstice. There's lots of sports to talk about. We're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton, and we're also going to be talking about actors turned politicians. That's all after this break.